when you have a message that matters in your story, all of a sudden it gives someone a reason to hold on to that story instead of just enjoying it and walking away.
Today on the show, we have Alex Benayan. Alex interviewed the world's most successful people like Bill Gates, Tim Ferriss, Steven Spielberg, Lady Gaga, and the technique he used to get into their office to get these interviews is wild. He's the author of a book called The Third Door, and today he's gonna go deep on his storytelling secrets that are gonna show you how to tell the most captivating stories ever and get your door knock answered. If there's any mega successful person you wanna meet, you can use his method to get past the security, past the gatekeeper, and into their office. It's coming up now.
Dude, I'm stoked now. That was a good start.
All right, we'll start right now. Alex Benayan, welcome to the show.
What's
my
up,
man?
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Of course.
You're a busy man these days. You are big in Japan.
It's been very surreal.
No, I mean, I'm actually not joking. You're like a celebrity in Japan right now.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Let's start there.
Well, what's crazy is that, you know, I started this book in my dorm room.
Yes, the book is The Third Door.
The book is
amazing.
The Third Door.
Book.
Thank yes. you very much. You know, I started when I was 18 years old in my college dorm room. And this pretty much 10-year journey of like studying success, I obviously had a dream that it would be big. You know, the real goal was to help, you know, inspire the next generation to believe in what's possible. And on the one hand, you know, my dream was definitely to, you know, have it in the U.S. and do well. And of course, you know, thankfully the book did do well here.
I mean, you were on the billboard in Times Square, right?
Yeah.
That was awesome.
That was really cool.
Yeah.
My mom was there on that day. It was like
yeah.
really surreal.
You got the blue check mark?
The blue check mark.
That's right.
And yeah, the book became a national bestseller when it came out in the U.S. But what's definitely been the most... You want to hear the crazy story of the Japan thing? Like the... Okay.
Do I?
Okay, this is... I actually haven't like talked about this openly. One of my best friends and I... And this is like a year before the book came out. As you know, my dad passed away before the book came out. And... It was an excruciatingly hard time because when it comes to pancreatic cancer, when you have, let's say, 12 months to live, it's almost like a 12-month dying process. So after he passed, it felt like I'd pretty much been at a funeral for 12 months. Mm. And I was actually at Elliot Bisno's house a couple months after just trying to get some fresh air spiritually. And I was actually in the guest bedroom of his house and it was like 3 a.m. and I just couldn't sleep. And I'm like, I need to be myself again. And I knew I had a couple months after I would be done writing where I would be editing and before I would have to start marketing the book where I couldn't really be anywhere in the world. And I decided to give myself a gift of going. I told myself, you can just go anywhere you want to edit the book. You don't have to tell anyone. And for some reason, the first thing that came to mind was Japan. I'd never been there. I don't know anyone in Japan. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, I just opened my phone and I booked myself a ticket to spend a couple weeks in Japan. And
no.
I ended up going. This is, again, a year before the book comes out. And a friend of mine heard about my plan and he wanted to join. So we both went. We go. We had this like amazing, beautiful trip in Japan. Like I'm so in love with the culture and the energy and the people. And on like the third to last day of the trip, it's like 10 o'clock at night. We're on a bus in Tokyo and the buses are like really quiet there. It's like really clean and polite and quiet. And we're like standing on the bus and there's this old Japanese man sitting in front of us. I'm standing up and he's reading a book in Japanese. And I'm doing the final edits of The Third Door. And I look at my friend Max and I whisper to him, I'm like, that's my dream. He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, I didn't write The Third Door for, you know, my buddy in, you know, LA or New York to read the book. My dream is for someone who I'll never meet, who I can't even speak the same language as them, to be impacted by these lessons and these stories. And my friend Max was like, dude, why don't you just Third Door it? Why don't you, you know, hire a translator and do this and get self-published? And I'm like, dude, that's not really how the system works. It has to become like a big bestseller, and then it gets translation rights. It's like this whole system. And Max is like, whatever, suit yourself. go to sleep, and I swear to God, the next morning at like, you know, 6, 7 a.m., I wake up, and I get a text message from my literary agent, and she has never texted me in our like 5 years of working together.
And this is before the book's out?
This is before the book's out. It's the next morning.
Okay.
And she says, call me immediately. So I'm like freaking out, thinking like something disastrous happened with the publisher. And I call him like, what's the matter? And she said, you're not going to believe this. You've just gotten the biggest Japanese publishing deal I've seen in my entire career. And I obviously immediately thought my friend Max was pranking me, must have gotten her info and like told her about it.
Right.
And I'm like, haha, very funny. And she's like, no, I'm serious. This is ridiculous. And I'm like, you know, I'm in Tokyo right now. And now she thought I'm messing with her. And it just coincidentally, when I made that wish, that was also the day that the deal came through. But I had nothing to do with it. I had no idea. And I actually met the Japanese editor 2 days later, right before I went back to the US. And fast forward a year and a half later, you know, the Third Door comes out in the U.S. It's time for the international launches. We did book tours in Italy and Korea and China and Bulgaria and Spain. And when it came to the Japanese launch, when I landed in Tokyo, I found out, because the launch was the next morning, but the book had come out the day I landed, that the book debuted as the number one book in the entire country.
Wow. Kismet, man. That's wild.
It's very surreal.
Dang. And so for people who haven't read the book, it's called The Third Door, The Wild Quest to Uncover How the World's Most Successful People Launch Their Careers. You basically took your, you know, man, I can't even tell this story quickly. Okay, you need to read this freaking book because it's amazing. But basically, Alex somehow used his own technique called The Third Door, which is a way of finding secret passageways to get what you want, to interview the world's biggest icons, Warren Buffett, Steven Spielberg, Lady Gaga, Tim Ferriss, Bill Gates. I mean, there's the list goes on. And some secret folks as well, like, what was it, Ki Liu, the guy who worked his way up to the head of Microsoft from being a cook or something like that.
Grew up in a village outside Shanghai, China. So it's sort of like a Coachella lineup. There's the big names, like
Bill Gates
and Lady Gaga. But also, if you go to a concert, it's sometimes the names in the small print that like blow you away the
most.
Right,
right. And Elliot Bisnow, a close friend of ours, his story is one of the best in the whole book. He's not as well known, but what he's doing behind the scenes is changing the world. So, So cool. So, I mean, the success in the U.S. was great, but let's talk about what's happening in Japan now, because this is so mind-blowing.
It's actually pretty crazy. So I did the original book launch in Japan a few months ago, and it went so well that we actually went back 2 months later for a follow-up book tour, but this time with Marie Kondo, which is actually she's well-known in Japan. She's even more well-known in the U.S. because of her Netflix reality show, you know, Tidying Up with Marie Kondo.
Right, and she wrote The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, which has been on the bestseller list for
sold, like
hundreds of weeks.
Yeah, it's sold, like 10 million copies.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a giant, giant success.
It's become a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
Like a way
and
of cleaning
really
her house.
And she's really young. She's 34 years old.
Yeah.
And her first book, Life-Changing Magic, came out when she was also 25 or 26.
And you told me that she reached out to you.
Her and her husband have a company called KonMari Media, which is her media company. When the book came out in Japan, because it got so much press attention there, and of course they're Japanese, he was reading the Japanese newspaper, heard about the book, read the book, and they reached out. And you know, a couple of days later, me and Marie and her husband, Takumi, were meeting here in Los Angeles.
Amazing. And how many copies have you sold in Japan? Can we talk about that?
I don't know the most recent, but when I was there, when it debuted, within the first week, we had 110,000 copies already in print.
It's so wild.
Within the first week.
Wow, the first week. That's amazing. Okay, so this comes from writing a damn good book. And I want to talk about that with
you. That's, by the way, first of all, the nicest compliment. Because I know you and I both like to think about marketing and strategy and stuff like that, but that compliment goes to the heart and soul of what I believe in and why I do this. So I just want to say thank you.
Well, you're welcome and well deserved. You know, being in the business of helping people get their message out, I see a lot of books that they do the game, they do the marketing ploy, and it gets on the bestseller list for a week, and then it's gone. And they get to say,
that's why I like the
content, you know, oh, I was a bestseller, and they get to put that in their marketing. And that's why a lot of people do that initial burst. But if the book doesn't have the gusto, if it doesn't have the meat inside of it, if it isn't an engaging read, and what I think is really important is it has to have a shareable concept so people can tell their friends about it. So Marie Kondo, Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, you can tell your friend, hey, this is a way of cleaning your house. And the way you do it is you grab something. You say, does this bring me joy? If it doesn't, you throw it out. So your book, The Third Door, you can say really simply, if you think about a nightclub,
right,
there's three ways in. There's a front door where all the, you know, bridge and tunnel crowd is going.
99% of people just wait in line hoping to get in.
VIP table crowd, which is like, you know, celebrities or the people who buy the tables or, you know, people in the scene.
Yeah.
And then there's the third door, which is through the kitchen or...
Right. Run down the alley, bang on the door 100 times, crack open the window. Exactly.
Yeah.
There's always a way in.
Always a way in.
And that's really, I would say, if there was one sentence that summed up and sums up the entire energy of the book, is that there's always a way.
Yes. And my favorite part of the book is that you were using this method to get to all these people, to get to Bill Gates, to get to Steven Spielberg, to get to Warren Buffett.
Unknowingly, though, funny enough. Unknowingly.
Yes, you were using it.
At the time, yeah.
And then each time you interviewed them, you found out that that is what they had done
right, to
get so successful. That was a big part of each of their careers, almost universally, right?
Yes, and what's funny is when I started out writing the book, that was not the plan. The plan was I'm going to go and just interview them and transcribe their interviews, and that would be the book. When I was done with the journey, that's when I realized, first of all, the journey is a meta story of all of their stories too. You know, Bill Gates did some crazy stuff when he was, you know, 19 years old to get his first sale. Steven Spielberg did some ridiculous things to get his first contract to be the youngest director in Hollywood history. But this is what like Forbes and CNBC like doesn't talk about.
Yeah, let's Let's tell him the Spielberg one because that's pretty
interesting. The Spielberg one is,
for people who don't know it.
You know, everyone knows Spielberg for his big movies, you know, Jaws and Schindler's List and E.T., but what most people don't know is Steven Spielberg was the youngest major studio director in Hollywood history. And that's very interesting to me because there's a lot of young directors who want major contracts, but almost none get it. So I did some investigating and I found out that Spielberg, when he was about, you know, 17, 18, applied to film school. You know, his dream was to be a director, applied to film school and he didn't get in. But of course, he was very persistent. So he applied a second time and still didn't get in. And most people would stop there. Spielberg, on the other hand, decided to take his education to his own hands. He went to Universal Studios here in Los Angeles, where they have this ride, the tram ride, which takes you on the back lot of Universal
Studios.
It's
a tour.
Yeah, it's a tour. I guess back then security was a bit more lax because as the tram went around the back lot, Spielberg jumped off the tram, hid in a bathroom, waited for the tram to drive away, and he started walking around on the lot. And eventually he bumped into this older gentleman named Chuck Silvers, who was the head of the Universal Television Library. And Chuck Silvers sees this 19-year-old kid wandering around by himself and says, you know, who the hell are you? And Spielberg told him the truth. He said, my name is Steven. My dream is to be a director. I jumped off the tram. And they end up talking for an hour. And at the end, Chuck Silvers says, how would you like to come back on the lot the next day? Spielberg's like, that would be a dream. So Chuck Silvers ends up writing a 3-day pass for Spielberg to come back onto the lot. And Spielberg comes back the first day and the second day and the third day. And on the fourth day, Spielberg wears a suit, like carries his father's briefcase, walks right up to the security gate, waves a hand in the air and says, hey, Scotty. And the guard just waves back and Spielberg walks right in. And he ends up doing this for months. He's sneaking into editing rooms, on sound stages. He's asking directors and actors and producers out to lunch. And he's essentially creating his own film school on his own.
Mm.
And after months of this, Chuck Silvers eventually becomes Spielberg's mentor. And Chuck Silvers sat him down one day and told him some very hard advice. He said, look, Spielberg, there has to be a day in your life where you realize you have to stop schmoozing and create something of value to show to people. You know, we all know those people. You know, I was in that stage for a lot of my life where your mindset is very much about getting to know the people, but you actually don't have anything to show.
Oh, man, I have a couple of friends and they hang out with all these huge celebrities and they just keep doing it. They're getting older and it's like, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, you're around all
the people. Yeah, look, there's a value to it, but I think Chuck Silver's advice was very, very wise. And so it could be hard to swallow, but Spielberg, you know, acknowledged that it was really important. So he didn't come back onto the lot and ended up spending months filming and editing this short film called Amblin. And it's this 22-minute film, and he funded it on his own. And he comes back to Chuck Silver's after months and shows him this short film. And it's so good that at the end, a single tear came down Chuck Silver's cheek. And Chuck Silver's reaches for the phone and calls the vice president of Universal Production, Sid Sheinberg. And he tells the vice president, he's like, look, Sid, I have something you gotta see. And the vice president's like, look, there's a lot of things people tell me I gotta see. And Chuck Silver goes, trust me, if you don't watch this, someone else will. And the vice president's like, you think it's that goddamn important? And Chuck Silver says, yes, it's that goddamn important. And sure enough, the vice president watched it that night. And Spielberg, the next morning, he was like at his community college, got a call saying he needs to be on the Universal lot immediately. He shows up in the vice president's office, and on the table is a contract making the youngest director in Hollywood history.
So wild. Hey, I hope you're enjoying these stories as much as I am. I want to know from you, who should I interview next? Maybe it's your favorite celebrity, your favorite athlete, your favorite author, or just someone you know who has a story that's never been told before. Comment below, let me know who it is, and then hit that subscribe button so you get notified when I interview the person that you pick.
Now, there's a lot of elements to that story that made it work, right?
Yeah.
Of course, the most important, tremendous talent and skill.
Yes.
That's your ticket to even play the game.
Okay.
But the question is, you know, there's a lot of people who also have tremendous talent and skill. How come Spielberg got it and other people didn't? And to me, it's sort of, I sort of see this like three-step process. He had the courage to, you know, jump off the tour bus. Mm-hmm. He found his inside man in the form of Chuck Silvers. And then he used that inside man to get his foot into the door. And the key part of that puzzle to me really seems to be that inside man, that inside person, inside woman, you know, Chuck Silvers. Because without Chuck Silvers, this story falls apart.
Right.
And to me, an inside man, an inside person, is anyone inside the organization you dream of getting into who believes in you enough for almost personal reasons that they're willing to risk their reputation on the line to get you in. And you can look at the stories of Warren Buffett with his mentor, Benjamin Graham. You can look at, you know, stories of Bill Gates, of Lady Gaga. There's always been that inside man, that inside woman, that inside person who's completely changed their careers.
Wow, love that. So the book is full of these stories, and they're so rich and so engaging. So how did you learn as a college kid to tell stories like that? Because the book is funny too, man. Like, are you just naturally a good storyteller and a writer?
Do you know what's funny? There's this anecdote in like my family that I, of course, don't remember because I was, you know, 2 or 3 years old. But my mom and grandma tell the story. Apparently, I didn't know how to put words together when I was, I guess at 3 years old, you're supposed to be able to like speak in sentences. And I couldn't for some reason. And they were like very worried about me. Mm. And my mom took me and my sister to Disneyland when I was like 3. And I came back. And this is how the story goes. I don't remember this. I came back to my grandma's house after coming to Disneyland, and I was so excited because I apparently watched this like goofy play at Disneyland. I wanted to tell her about it, but I didn't know how to put the words together. So according to my grandma, I spent the next 30 minutes acting out every scene of the play for her so she could experience what I experienced. So that's like this little anecdote that to me like sort of symbolized, because a lot of The Third Door is me reenacting these experiences that I went through that changed my life.
Mm.
And what's interesting is, yeah, I definitely had an inclination throughout my whole life of, you know, orally telling stories.
Yes.
But it wasn't until I started writing The Third Door that I realized the art of telling a story out loud and the art of writing a page-turning, suspenseful narrative is like saying, oh, I'm good at sports. I'm really good at swimming. How hard could baseball be? That's, I thought I was good at sports.
Okay.
And what I was really good at, I was good at swimming.
Got it.
And it wasn't until I met a man. So I ended up halfway along the journey interviewing Larry King. And Larry King introduced me to one of his best friends by the name of Cal Fussman. And Cal Fussman is this writer at Esquire magazine who's written the What I've Learned column. He's a New York Times bestselling author. And I end up realizing, oh my God, Larry King just introduced me to one of the most remarkable writers of a generation who wasn't, Cal wasn't well known at all at that point in his life. And Cal and I ended up developing this friendship where he was in a point of his life where he was struggling. You know, the magazine industry was shrinking and he didn't know what his future would be. He had three kids, one in college. And I was showing him, you know, the world of the internet and all the possibilities and all the opportunity. And I was helping him there and he was helping me because I was in the opposite position. I understood the internet and marketing and all that stuff, but I didn't know how to tell a compelling story with a written word. That was his expertise. So we started spending for about 3 to 4 years, three nights a week for about 3 hours a night.
For three to four years.
And we would spend about half the time him going over like a draft of, you know, a chapter. And he would, you know, sort of like Mr. Miyagi, tell me wax on, wax off.
Yeah.
He's like, it's not ready. It's not ready. It's not. His rule of helping mentor me through writing was he would, the only thing he would tell me concretely is rewrite or you're done. And sometimes the Bill Gates chapter, Cal made me rewrite it 152 times. And that's before it goes to my publisher, to my editor, to be edited.
Wow.
Now, I say that with the most amount of gratitude because, and I say this, Cal changed my life. Sometimes it even feels like he saved my life. Because narrative writing, and you know, you're a remarkable writer yourself, is a very specific type of writing.
Right.
Because before I started writing the narrative of The Third Door, I was writing articles for, you know, LinkedIn and Fast Company, which were, you know, doing really well and going viral. But a blog post and a 300-page, single page-turning, suspenseful narrative have nothing to do with each other.
And you had to nail this, too, right?
I felt...
I mean, you had spent your entire adult life getting these stories.
I had dropped out of college. My parents are refugees and came to America with the dream of me being a doctor. I turned my back on that. I felt like I shattered my family's hopes and dreams.
You swore on your grandma's life.
I swore on my grandma's life that I'd finish college. I didn't finish college. And when I went to get these interviews, you know, Bill Gates didn't say yes to an interview with me because he liked me. He went because there was this promise that I made, which is, if you share an hour of your wisdom with me, I'll take what you're telling me and share it with my generation in a way that will really help them. And I felt almost this moral obligation to put everything I had into fulfilling that promise.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to come back to more of the writing process, okay, but this sparked a question in my mind. Now that it's out, have any of the folks in here seen it? Mm-hmm. And told you about their thoughts on them.
You know what's funny? When I was writing, I'm like, I'm not writing it for... No, there's a part of me, of course, and I have to be honest with myself. I admire... Everyone in the book are people I admire. I didn't just interview people on the Forbes 100 list. I admired the people that I thought...
Yeah, you sat down, you made your dream university of professors.
Exactly.
Warren Buffett for finance, Bill Gates for building a business, Tim Ferriss for lifestyle optimization, things
exactly.
like that, right? Yeah.
And... Yeah, I cared. And it was only until I was done writing that I realized, and I finally was at peace that this book wasn't for the interview subjects to like me. This is for the readers to have value and to change their lives.
Mm.
But at the same time, when the book came out and I started getting feedback, naturally.
Yeah, I mean, that forced you to write it well.
Yeah.
So it's also going to have a side effect of everyone else getting value, if these people are going to get value because they have high standards.
Yes. It was cool. I think, who was the first one to get feedback? Oh, do you know what happened? I sent the paper galleys to all the interview subjects. The only person who asked not to get a paper galley was Tim Ferriss. He asked it for to be emailed to him as a PDF.
Okay, because they were going to get final cut. Is that why?
No,
or was it?
No. Okay. The book was done when they read it.
Okay.
Which that was a tricky line to toe, because normally if someone's writing a book on Bill Gates gets to sort of say, hey. But with this book, that wasn't the situation.
Did you just not mention that into the interviews with them, that, hey, you're not going to get final cut, or did you tell them?
It wasn't asked. Okay. But we approached these interviews like a journalistic interview, where we're sitting down, it's being audio recorded, and their words will be, you know, written in this book.
Got it.
So it was very much a journalistic code of conduct.
Got it.
Tim Ferriss was the first person to reply, and he's first of all, I'm very grateful for him, because he helped play a big role in getting the book deal itself. You know the story of how I first met him, which I hid in a bathroom and jumped out and sent him 32 emails, and he didn't like me at all in the beginning, rightfully so. But he said, email me the PDF. I'm super, super busy this week. I have no idea if I'll be able to read it, but just send it over and I'll try to take a look. I sent it to him, and like 3 hours later, he's like, oh shit, man, I'm so proud of you. And I have no idea how much he had read, but he said, when he was texting me, he's like, I'm only a few chapters in. And do you know the compliment he gave, I'll never forget. He said, this is him speaking. He said, I know how many revisions it takes to have such smooth prose. So I know how much you put into this. I'm so proud of you.
Wow.
And that really went to my heart, because sometimes it did feel very isolating, me and Cal sitting, you know, for 154 edits. And I'm thinking, no one's going to know how many times this one sentence was debated. Whether that comma should be there or not is a debate. One comma in a 300-page book, I'm not kidding. I'm not exaggerating.
I do it.
Debate. Is a debate. You know, people would obviously think, is this chapter going to be in the book? That's, of course, a debate. No. We would debate commas. We would debate dashes. We would debate, is this two sentences or one sentence? And it would be even the final word, not the final sentence, the final word. I was thinking about this morning. The final word of the third door was a 1.5-hour discussion with Cal of what word does this entire book end on.
I can tell you right now. I'm not going to say it. Should we say it?
It's the word home.
It's a powerful closing sentence.
It's the word home.
Yeah.
And the opening word was also an hour-long debate. The opening word of the third door is the word right. The opening sentence is right this way. Because that very much is symbolic of the whole journey.
I love that.
Right this way, you're actually ushering in. It's actually symbolic, too, of the cover, too.
Ushering in the reader.
Ushering a reader into a new world.
Love that.
Right this
way. That's
a
powerful opening.
And the final word, home, is that on the surface, this is a book about success and achievement and accomplishment.
Yeah.
But beneath the surface, this is a book about belonging and fulfillment.
So let's talk about that opening, too, because I have a lot of friends send me their book drafts.
Yeah.
And the thing I notice on most book drafts is the intro starts off, I, me, I did this, I did that, blah, 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 blah. There's no acknowledgement of the reader. And I love that first sentence, right this way, is metaphorically ushering in the reader to take a journey.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't think he'll mind me sharing, but Elliot sent me the Summit book. Mm-hmm. And that was the first thing that I did. I was like, edit, Elliot, I'm only making edits on the intro. That's the only thing I'm gonna touch. And he's like, why would you do that? Like, there's all this whole book here. And I was like, no, this is the most important part of the book. People pick it up and you lose them at the intro, they're putting the book back on the shelf. Yeah. This is when you have to grab them. And I just added some copy to the intro to let the reader know that, okay, this is for you. Mm-hmm. This is gonna help you with these dreams, hopes, and desires that you've been having. and you're about to go on an extraordinary journey. Those are the three things I tried to put in that introduction when I read it. And I think all introductions need to have that. And you can do it in a different way. You can either tell the reader, hey, this is about to
either
be a journey.
Explicitly,
this is exciting,
or implicitly.
Or implicitly, like you did, which brings them right into the journey of you walking into the office of Bill Gates.
Yeah. And I think what you've learned, you know, just through copywriting is knowing that at the end of the day, people respond when you put them first.
Absolutely.
That's the whole point of why you create a product, why you create art, is in service to the viewer or the reader.
Yes. And
or the customer.
The other thing I tell people too, with this style of book, it's a little bit different. But let's take one of my favorite books of the last year, Never Split the Difference, by Chris Voss.
Yep, I like that one a lot.
One of the greatest business tactical books of all time. It's about negotiating. Something I learned a long time ago from a brilliant copywriter named John Carlton.
Okay.
No one wants to read your fucking book. No one actually wants to read Never Split the Difference.
Right.
They want to take a pill and become a master negotiator. No one wants to sit through a 200-page book, do a bunch of exercises. They just want to be a ninja negotiator. They just want to get the best prices. I mean, actually, maybe even on another level, no one wants to be a master negotiator. They just want to get the cheapest price handed to them. But I think there is some joy in negotiating that people get a kick out of, you know, more so than like, you know, Tim Ferriss' 4-Hour Work Week. It's like, to get your week to only 4 hours takes many, many hours.
Right.
Many hours of planning and shit like that that people would rather not do. People would much rather snap their fingers and only have to work 4 hours a week, you know? So this book is a really enjoyable book. It might be one of those books, I would say, when you're kind of sad it's over because you just were taken on a thrilling journey. So a little bit of a different idea. But it's mostly about, you know, what they can do next. Like that is always going to be a bigger journey for someone who applies the concept, is what they can do with the concept of the third door after they close the book. That's when the real
and
journey
that's
comes again.
One of the things that surprised me the most, you know, I wrote the book really for, in my mind, for my generation. That was, you know, where my heart and soul was. But what's been, so I knew that was sort of like the area that I was going for.
Yeah.
The stage in life I was going for. What's been surprising, you know, very pleasantly surprising, is I've had, I was keynoting at, you know, Intuit's annual meeting, and after my speech, the CEO literally walked out, CEO of Intuit, you know, one of the biggest tech companies in the world, walked out with a copy of the book and said, I just want to say this, Alex doesn't know I was doing this, but this book changed my life. So there's that extreme. Also, I'll open Twitter and see parents sending photos of their 8-year-old's book report of The Third Door.
Yeah.
And what's so cool is I'm seeing this book report and the kids get it. Like they would be like, I'll remember this line, this like 8-year-old made this like poster board and it said, the point of this book is that it's the failures he had along the way that made him who he is. I'm like, yeah, I'm like so proud of this 8-year-old.
Oh my gosh.
I'm like, yes, you got it. Like, dude, if I understood that at eight, like, that's amazing. Yeah.
And it's not the sitting on the couch reading the book that changes the life. It's taking the lessons and applying them that changes the lives. So, yeah, wonderful way that your book captures both of those things. So back to the writing process. Mm-hmm. Other than rewrite 100 times, what are some actual tactical things people can do to improve their writing?
Writing or storytelling? Because they're two different, complementary, but different skills.
Great question. Let's talk about storytelling and print.
Okay. When it comes to storytelling and I've actually been giving this a lot of thought too, because when I was doing The Third Door, I was practicing it, but now in hindsight, I've been zooming out and seeing how it works. And I've been doing workshops for MasterCard and Merrill Lynch on this topic too.
Yeah, and sorry, but to differentiate based on your question, would it be fair to say that if you are a great writer, that all writing should be storytelling in print? Because stories help people understand concepts.
The answer is yes, but it's sort of like architecture versus interior design.
Okay.
If someone says, I build houses, their firm or whatever is doing both.
Yeah.
They're not like, oh, I build houses, but I'm only good at the wood beams.
Got it.
No, you're good at...
Okay.
If you're good at building houses, if you're good at writing a book, if you're good at writing, you're good at prose, and you're good at storytelling.
Got it.
Fair. Right?
Yes.
Tim Ferriss, good at both. You're good at both. But if someone wants to really dissect the art of writing, you have to separate storytelling and prose and master both and then marry them together. So just discussing clean prose that's enjoyable to read is one thing.
Yeah.
Storytelling is, you need to master storytelling before you even put a word on the page.
And doing that verbally.
Correct. Well, verbally, but even just in your head, understanding what the story is. And I'll literally break down for you what in my mind I call, you know, third door storytelling.
Yes.
And these are the five elements that it doesn't matter if you're writing a book, if you're writing marketing copy, if you're doing sales, business development, you know, networking and just telling your personal story. These five elements, I sort of spent the past couple of years really thinking, if I could give someone on the street five things that they could just instantly understand and put into their pocket, that would change the quality of their storytelling and the quality of their life. These would be the five things.
All right, so get your pens and paper out, okay, get your notepad.
And the way I think about it is, you know, in like a sound booth in a music studio, there's all those like knobs and levels.
Yes.
I had to think, what are the, you know, in storytelling, there's a lot of knobs and levels. What are the five that if you tweak them, change the entire song?
Yeah.
So these are the five.
Okay.
And they're in a very specific order. I'll tell you the five and then we can, you know, dissect them one by one. The first one is origin. Number one is origin. The first one is origin. The second one is intention.
Okay.
Origin, intention. The third one is obstacle. The fourth one is transformation. And the fifth one is a lesson that matters. A lesson, a message that matters. Okay, now let's break them down very quickly.
Okay.
This is something I can talk about for hours and hours.
All right.
But I'll give you the compact version. Origin, for example. Let's use the best-selling book in modern history, Harry Potter. There's two ways you can describe that book. Number one, here is a story of the world's greatest wizard who takes on the Dark Lord, becomes the best Quidditch player in Hogwarts history, and saves the wizarding world from imminent disaster.
Okay.
That accurately describes the book.
Okay.
Or you can say, this is the story of an orphan who's living in a cupboard under the staircase of his uncle and aunt's house, who has no friends, has no meaning, and has no sense of belonging. And all of that changes one day when an owl appears with a letter. Which version do you think J.K. Rowling used for the back cover of Harry Potter? The second one.
Wow. And the second one is so much more emotionally grabbing.
But isn't
the first one is the story.
The first one is the story. And the first one is if you gave it to a committee of marketers, like, oh, that's a story.
Right.
But that's not the one that became the best-selling book in history.
Wow.
It's the second one.
Wow.
And if you look at it, what J.K. Rowling, what every great writer understands, is human beings. Because at the end, storytelling is emotional architecture. Storytelling is emotional architecture. And you need an entrance point into the reader or the listener. And that entrance point is an origin that the listener or the viewer or the reader relates to. And everyone, I don't care if you're Barack Obama or if you are living in a township in South Africa, it doesn't matter where you are or who you come from, everyone can relate to feeling like an outsider, to not having a sense of belonging, and wanting a sense of deeper meaning. Everyone is Harry under that cupboard at some point in their life. Number one, origin. So the key that I'll tell people who want to be better storytellers, ask yourself when you're looking at your story, whether it's your personal life story or a story you're writing in a book, is not how can I add more bells and whistles to my origin to make it more exciting, but how can you strip away all the bells and whistles so you actually get to the core humanity the vulnerable, raw, uncomfortable truth of how this story got started. That's number one. Number two, intention. Let's talk about the best, as an example, the best, you know, the highest grossing comedy trilogy of all time, the movie The Hangover. The movie The Hangover is, you know, the highest grossing comedy trilogy. And if you look at the movie The Hangover, there's two ways the movie could have been written. Let's say the first movie is, first version of it, is here's a movie about, you know, three buddies who go to Las Vegas and do these crazy things. And, you know, they're losing a tooth and they're doing this. And, you know, it's crazy. You want to watch this movie? I don't know, maybe. Who's in it? You know?
Okay, yeah.
Here's the second way to write that movie or pitch that movie. Here's a story of three best friends who lose their fourth best friend the day before his wedding. And if they do not find him in the next 24 hours, all of their lives are essentially over. You're going to watch that movie. And then the comedy is just frosting on the cake.
Yeah.
Right?
Because you need to know how that ends up.
You have to know.
Yeah.
And that's the power of intention. A story without a hardcore intention is not a story. It's just funny events or interesting events, but it's not a story. What glues someone to the seat is a reason, either a life and death reason, physically or emotionally. For me, it wasn't a physical life and death thing with the third door, but it was an emotional, spiritual, like, what am I going to do with my life?
Yeah, yeah.
What? I am in a crisis. My entire family came to this country for me to be a doctor. My soul is being sucked away from these by these pre-med books. And if I don't figure this out, I will completely ruin my entire family sacrifice. My life will be a failure. And I'll enter the abyss of, you know, whatever.
And I didn't even get that until you just said it now.
Right, but that's the point, you're not supposed to say it.
Yeah.
But no, when I was writing
that's like the glue that keeps
literally paragraphs that me and Cal structured to make it, you want your intention to be, it's almost like pounding dough. You want to really compact it, you know? So it's really tight where there's not a question in the reader's mind that this is really damn important. And there's consequences if this doesn't get solved. If I told you, hey, do you want to hear about this crazy road trip I had? You're like, sure, but I got to run in a few minutes. What happened? And I said, hey, let me tell you about the time where my grandpa was in the hospital and I was told he only has, you know, 1 week left to live and I had to drive across the country to get to him. You're like, what happened? Right? Because there's an intention. All right, so that's number two. And again, a question you can ask yourself if you want to be a better storyteller is how can I up the stakes of the intention to make the reader glued to their seat?
Up the stakes. Love that.
Up the stakes. How can you really, because the truth is people think, oh, I've upped the stakes as much as I can. No. You have to go into the emotional elements, the psychological elements. What bad things will happen? And what's funny is when you're a storyteller, you think it's obvious to the listener why it matters to you. It is not obvious. You need to make it very clear. You have to up the stakes. That's number two. Number three is obstacles. Now, let's go back to Harry Potter as an example. Let's say I told you, oh, great book. This kid becomes a wizard. Oh my God, he just kills this guy Voldemort on his first encounter with him. Smooth sailings. It's a really beautiful story. You'd be like, what's the story? A story is when you have an intention and there's obstacles along the way stopping you from getting you what you want. That's a story. That's the meat, right? If I told you, you know, Harry wanted to kill Voldemort and he walked up to Voldemort and killed him, there's no story.
Right. If this was just like Warren Buffett, here's what I learned from Warren Buffett. Bill Gates. Here's what I learned from Bill Gates. It's not an engaging book.
If my father was Warren Buffett or my grandfather was Warren Buffett and I wrote a book about wanting to interview Bill Gates and the book starts off with, I was at my grandpa's annual meeting and I turned to Bill Gates and asked him, how do you become successful? And this is what he told me. It might be a nice article, but
right.
Like,
yeah.
That's not a story.
Right.
And again, that's something Cal had to show me. I wanted, and I think this is a trap a lot of business writers fall into. A lot of people, especially people who are CEOs of companies who are writing stories about their companies, I see this a lot. Their instinct is to portray the best version of themselves and of their company, which means you don't talk about all the times the shit hit the fan. But if you read some of the best memoirs in the business world, you know, Shoe Dog by Phil Knight, they're really just stories of failures, right?
Dude, this is so wild because I'm putting together an important business prospectus for my company right now mm-hmm. that's going to go to someone else that's really important. I don't want to say who it is, but it's like, you know, big scale. And I'm going to redo it now based on this because it's all like the highlights, but there's nothing of the struggle. And that's going to make it so much more powerful.
And, you know, that's the, you know, again, if someone wants to be a better writer, a better storyteller, a question to ask yourself is how can I shine the spotlight brighter on the obstacles along the way? Because the truth is they're there. Just your natural human instinct because of shame is to not talk about it. But that's what gives the story. You know, if intention glues the reader to their seat, the obstacles bring them to the edge of their seat.
Ah, I love that.
There's this great line by this very famous playwright that says, a story is putting someone in a corner, trapping them, and seeing how they get out. That's a story. Every good story is someone is trapped in a corner and you're trying to see how they're going to get themselves out. The third door is a story of an 18-year-old who drops out of college to interview Bill Gates and literally his family falls apart, his grandma's crying, his mom won't talk to him, and Bill Gates won't respond to any of his emails. What the fuck is this kid going to do, you know, when his entire dream is over?
Yeah.
So that's obstacle. Number four, transformation. This is when it starts feeling like a story. There's always been, let's go back to Harry Potter because it's just such a clear example. If the book Harry Potter starts off with Harry feeling no sense of belonging, no sense of purpose, no sense of family, and he overcomes, he has the intention, he has the obstacles, he kills Voldemort at the end, and the book ends with Harry walking off into the distance, wondering to himself, why do I feel so empty inside? Why do I have no sense of belonging? You would say, what kind of fucking book is this, right? You would be like, wow, that was really good. But that can't be the end. Because humans have this natural instinct of a knowing, a sense of knowing, that it's not the end of the story until there's been a complete transformation. If you stopped Harry Potter there, you would think, is there a chapter missing that didn't get printed? You wouldn't even be thinking there's no transformation, but you would feel, you've definitely watched a movie where you're like, the ending was close, but it didn't get it. It didn't get it means there wasn't a clear enough transformation.
Or what about, did you watch Game of Thrones?
No, but I heard a lot of people were disappointed by that.
So by blow the ending for you if you haven't seen it, if you don't mind. But arguably the person who's like the lead character or one of the top.
Yeah.
She makes an amazing transformation throughout the series from weak to very, very strong and very much a woman of the people. And at the ending, I think the reason people hated it is because she goes from a woman of the people to kind of like a power abuser.
Right. And that's not in line with the transformation. It doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
Now, look, it doesn't have to be a feel-good ending for there to be a transformation. Someone could start off being a good person, they end as an evil person, but that's still a story too. And this is something very important. Aristotle talks about this in his book, Poetics. Every great screenwriter understands this. Every great writer understands this. Someone's dialogue, what they say, is their personality. But the choices they make is who their character is. So you want a good book ends with someone making a choice that was very different than the kind of choice they would have made at the beginning of the story. And I was listening to Seth Rogen doing an interview once, and he said a great line. I think he was quoting someone else even. And he said, every great story, the most important thing in the beginning of the story has to become the least important thing at the end of the story. And the least important thing at the beginning of the story has to become the most important thing. And every great story follows that rule. And I was sitting there, this is after the third door come out, and I literally realized I had no idea of this, but that's exactly what happened with the third door. In the beginning of the book, what's the most important thing? Meeting Bill Gates, learning from Bill Gates, being successful like Bill Gates. That's the most, and what's the least important thing to me in the opening chapters? My family.
Yeah.
My mom's crying, I walk out, I slam the door. You don't get me, right? And at the end of the book, the least important thing to me is Bill Gates. Most important thing to me.
Ah, that makes so much sense. Yeah.
And I wasn't conscious of that, but if you write a good story, it just naturally happens.
Yeah.
All right, and the final one, number five, is a message that matters. And I one of the my favorite examples of this is if you look at the marketing world, you know better than anyone how many millions and millions, if not billions of dollars are spent on ad campaigns every year. And if you stop someone on the street and say, what are your 10 favorite ad campaigns? They might think of a few, but then they won't even be able to get to 10 after billions of dollars of people bombarding consumers.
Yeah.
But one of the things that almost everyone will remember is Apple's Think Different campaign, which came out, what, like 20 years ago. And what's so beautiful about that, and if you actually go to Steve Jobs, is there's an 8-minute video of Steve Jobs announcing the Think Different campaign within Apple. And it's a very famous video, and he talks about when you have a message that matters in your story, all of a sudden it gives someone a reason to hold on to that story instead of just enjoying it and walking away. And again, whether it's the third door, you know, Harry Potter on the surface is a book about, you know, wizards, but it's a story about the importance of courage, family, and love. It's a message that matters. And that's what makes something shareable. But even more importantly, that's what makes something personal. It makes a reader or a listener hold on to it for years to come. And these five elements, that's, you know, really how what I call, you know, third door storytelling, where if you can use just these five elements, whether you're writing, giving a speech, doing marketing copy, doing sales, it radically transforms your ability to have compelling, gripping stories.
Wow. I think I was meant to have this interview with you before I write my book, because it's going to be totally different now.
Thank you.
So much more powerful. Man, my mind is blown six ways to Sunday. I'm going to make everyone on my writing team at Golden Hippo watch this interview. That was absolutely fantastic. Thanks for sharing that, man.
Thank you, man.
Yeah. So people want to find you. AlexBenayan.com, Alex Benayan on Instagram, or is it thethirddoor.com, or where do people go?
Thirddoorbook.com is the book website.
Thirddoorbook.com.
The book is wherever people like to buy books, so whether that's Audible or Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Must read book, because not only you get the stories of how he met Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Tim Ferriss, the things he learned from them, you're going to see what he just talked about in action. The book is super freaking engaging. You're going to love the book.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for watching. If you want to hear a story that's even wilder than that one, click here. You only have 5 seconds though. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!